When George Washington sought to warn Americans about the most fearsome threats to their liberty, he did not cast his eyes toward Europe, where nations were waiting like vultures to pounce upon the carcass of a failed experiment in self-government. Instead, Washington challenged Americans to look within. We're going to talk about this right now. That, by the way, was the opening of an article by Dr. Joseph LeConte. And among other things, he's a professor at King's College, which is in New York City. I'm Jerry Newcomb. This is Vocal Point. And Dr. LeConte, it's great to have him in the program. Can I call you Joe?
Yes, please, Gary. It'll be great. Thanks for having me on the show.
No, that's great. And I'm Jerry. You can call me Jerry. Just don't call me late for supper.
Okay, Jerry.
No problem. Okay, so go ahead and tell us about this article, which you titled Realism, Religion, and the Republic. And we'll link to it, but I think there's something to learn here, especially Dr. LeConte, as I look around and you see all these young Americans with skulls full of mush, as Rush Limbaugh would put it, that don't appreciate what they have in America. They don't realize people are risking their lives to try and come here so they can make something of their lives, and instead they're just grousing about America and tearing down statues of Washington, wanting to rename, you know, the George Washington University, whatever, because they hate the founding of this country.
Yeah. I think so many of the critics, they really lack any historical perspective, Jerry, because when you think about what the founders achieved, first with the revolution in 1776 and at the Constitutional Convention, 1787, what they achieved was just so historically remarkable. It was so innovative. It was so daring. It had never been tried before to create a democratic republic spread out over a vast territory, this experiment in self-government, government by consent of the governed. And so you're going to have a political society not based on race, not based on religion or some other ethnic identity, not based on tribalism, but instead based on this idea. And what's the idea? Well, it's the idea of human equality, human freedom. It's the first time that any kind of political society comes into existence announcing, declaring those unalienable rights of every human soul under heaven. And I'm fully aware of the contradictions of the founders, their inconsistencies and their hypocrisy. Yet at the end of the day, what they gave us was a constitution, a declaration of the constitution that has made possible the freest and most prosperous nation on the planet. That's worth thinking about, isn't it?
Absolutely. Now, let me ask you about this, because I think it would be important to bring out a religious principle that they held to, which is that the Creator is the source of our rights. If you remove the Creator, then the American experiment is kind of it's like tearing the heart out of it.
Yeah, I think that's right in this sense in particular, Jerry, that when the founders spoke about universal natural rights, they never separated that concept from the idea of God. They, to a person, you could take the most irreligious among them, even Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson. They just assumed, they believed deeply that those, the concept of rights could not be separated. It could not be disconnected from the concept of a loving and just sovereign God. And that is important to think about, because that means that those rights, they're not granted to us by government. Government recognizes those rights and should be instituted among men for the sake of protecting those rights, right? That's the language of the Declaration, right?
Yeah. No, and it's very important. I mean, even John F. Kennedy said in 1961 when he was inaugurated, he said, you know, the key belief of our forebears, our forefathers, was the idea that our rights come not from the generous hand of the state, but rather from the hand of God. Okay, let's talk a little bit about George Washington's farewell address, which he delivered through the newspapers, not as a speech, but it's a very important document, 1796. And go ahead and wax eloquent, if you would, about how we need to look within, as you said, as opposed to looking to Europe, enemies abroad.
Yeah, and I can't wax eloquent like Washington could, but it is an amazing, it's a remarkable document. You know, at so many levels, Washington was setting the pattern, wasn't he? He was setting the precedent for what it is to be a president. That's important to think about how he conducted himself, but then laying out these foundational ideas, because he was deeply concerned. What's going to happen with the first transfer of political power? What's going to happen to the republic? And he emphasized the the virtues, the qualities of self-government that were going to be required, that were going to be necessary for the republic to be able to sustain itself. It's really the same kind of message that if I could bring up Abraham Lincoln here for a moment, because Lincoln said he never had a political sentiment that was not embodied in the Declaration of Independence. And Lincoln was very clear on this, just as Washington was, that our greatest threats aren't really coming from abroad. They're coming from within. That if men and women, if Americans forget this great legacy, if they forget what it means to govern themselves, the virtues, the beliefs, the ideals that are absolutely essential to self-government, if we let go of those, the institutions are not just going to run themselves. They're going to run down instead. And we're going to fall into tribalism and deep divisions. And guess what? That's where we are right now, right? In a huge way.
Yeah, comment, if you would, on the, you know, riots in the streets, Antifa, Black Lives Matters, you know, the sentiment Black Lives Matters, of course that's true, but the organization leaves a lot to be desired. In fact, they've taken advantage of all the millions they've received, yeah. And, you know, the co-founder, yeah. You know, gave new meaning to BLM. Now it's Buy Luxurious Mansions. Yeah. But what are your thoughts in terms right. of, you know, the right. Marxists in right. the streets? How do we, you know, deal with that?
Well, I think on the one hand, look, as an academic, as an historian, as an instructor in the classroom, I always want to be very clear-eyed about America's journey toward a democratic freedom and toward a society that's more just and humane. And it's been a journey. We're striving for a more perfect union. So I understand the anger that many people feel toward America's past. But there's a wonderful line from Winston Churchill. If we open up an argument with the past, we're going to find that we're going to lose the future. And what Churchill meant was, yes, reckon with your past, reckon with it honestly, but don't become obsessed with your failings, because there are too many challenges in the present. And it seems to me that we have a whole category of people who are absolutely obsessed with America's failings, historical failings, and then they look at the things that are not what they should be right now in America at different levels, in economic sense, in a racial sense, and I think they exaggerate some of this, quite frankly. And the problem is it's seeding this kind of what's going to be a storm, if I can mix metaphors here, a storm of disillusionment and resentment and anger and rage. And that, how does that help us move forward toward a more just society? How does violence in the streets help us move forward? Now, it's not just a left-wing problem. There are voices on the right, militant voices on the right. We want to be mindful of and check. But I don't think that's where the greatest threats are coming from right now in the United States. I think the real threats are coming from the hard left. And unfortunately, the hard left is finding a very comfortable home in the progressive movement and the Democratic Party. It's a huge political problem right now, this culture of rage and resentment, isn't it?
Yeah, and are you optimistic or pessimistic about the future? As you work with Heritage Foundation and you train new students at King's College, are you optimistic or pessimistic? What are your thoughts?
Well, dear, I like to use the word hopeful because, and as a person of Christian faith, we have very good reasons to remain hopeful as human beings because if I could just be very frank here, because of what God has done through his son Jesus on our behalf, and that Jesus is risen and the tomb is empty. And that in some ways that answers all my tough questions.
That's good. I like
that. There's a rational basis for hope, but there's also there's a faithful reason for hope, but there's also a very practical reason for hope. And that as an instructor, when I work with young people and help unpack the story of America's journey toward democratic freedom and the story of Western civilization and the progress we've made, and you do that clear-eyed with intellectual honesty, I think young people respond, because we all need to be encouraged by the great examples of men and women in the past who've stood against the tide, and they've done the right thing, and they've listened to the voice of conscience, and they've acted on it. And history is filled with those examples. Our own history has a lot of amazing examples of those men and women. But the problem is they're not hearing those stories, right? And they're just hearing all the dark tales of failure. Well, that's just not going to cut it. That doesn't cut it historically. It doesn't cut it in terms of academic intellectual honesty. So tell the story honestly, powerfully. And I think you can bring young people on board with a more hopeful and creative vision of what America can become than what we've got right now.
And here we have situations where, for example, the New York Times propelled on the national stage the 1619 yeah. Project, which yeah. postulates yeah. that America didn't really begin in 1776. Instead, it began yeah. when the first African-American or the first African slaves were brought over in 1619. How about a comment on just that, yeah. that historical project? I mean, that's a curriculum that is taught yeah. in several of our schools.
Yeah, it's kind of astonishing, Jerry. I'm glad you brought it up because my first career, my first degree, academic degree, was in journalism. I've worked as a reporter and as a newspaper editor. I understand what the standards of the profession are. And this is, has to be one of the most shameful episodes in the history of modern journalism. It's not the first time the New York Times has perpetuated a massive lie. It did that in the 1930s with its reportage of Joseph Stalin and what was happening in the Soviet Union.
By the way, didn't that guy, that Walter Duranty or something, didn't he win a Pulitzer?
Pulitzer Prize, and never there revoked. Is. So the New York Times is comfortable with propagating massive lies for the sake of its own ideological agenda. They're doing it again, and once again, they're getting the approval of the Pulitzer Prize Committee, which is awarded the prize for this. You really can't even call it. Well, certainly not a work of history. It's not even a work of journalism in that sense, because journalism used to have some relationship to the truth, and that's the huge problem with the 1619 Project. At the center of the thing is a lie. It doesn't mean that there aren't some useful things, scattered around the edges, but at the heart of the thing is a lie. And we ought to be standing against it and trying to figure out, okay, let's reckon with our past, but we need a little bit more intellectual honesty here.
All right. Can you explain critical race theory and how is that a problem in education?
Well, others have spent much more time looking at this. I think near the heart of the critical race theory project and what's wrong with it, it's similar to what's wrong with the Marxist project. And there are Marxists who've been associated and involved in critical race theory. Think about where Marx went wrong. Marx went wrong when he decided that all of history could be understood in the context of class struggle, and that private property was the great evil. If you could just get rid of private property, you would change human nature, you would end all class struggle, and you'd achieve a kind of political social nirvana. Everything seen through the lens of class. Well, what's critical race theory? It sees everything through the race of lens. Everything through the lens of race. So by oversimplifying, by grossly oversimplifying human nature and the nature of human societies, you then are left with what? You're left with a massive propaganda project. You're not interpreting history correctly. You're not understanding the human dilemma properly. And now you're going to try to force through political means a solution to a problem that you have improperly diagnosed. It's a recipe for disaster, an absolute, and it'll just turn young people against the country and create a sense of rootlessness and dissatisfaction and disillusionment, which I think ultimately contributes to all kinds of emotional problems. I mean, look at the raft of suicides and emotional problems young people have been having over the last number of years. Certainly the lockdown had something to do with it, but the way that we're just taking away any sense of pride in country and patriotism, this contributes, I think, to a great kind of emotional upheaval with young people. It's doing great damage.
Okay, we have about a minute left, and let's circle back to George Washington. Do you think George Washington, in his farewell address, has anything to say to modern America? 1 minute.
Oh, great question. Love it. Love that question. You know, when Washington said very explicitly that this republic depends on some pillars of support, and the two that he named, morality and religion. Those two pillars. Morality, in other words, you got to be able to govern yourself. You got to have the virtues necessary for self-government. And Washington knew we cannot acquire those qualities and sustain them without religious commitment, without faith commitment. Morality and religion deeply connected. They're joined at the hip. Washington knew it. He knew they were essential for a democratic republic. And unfortunately, the chattering class, the liberal elites and others, they have forgotten these fundamental truths, the great pillars of our republic. So that speaks to this moment, I think. I've been around for a while. I've never experienced in my lifetime the kind of dislocation, the disillusionment, the anger, the breakdown in social order. I've never quite seen it in my lifetime. So it is troubling. it can be turned around with good leadership, with the involvement of people of faith. But there's nothing inevitable about the American experiment succeeding and sustaining itself. Experiments can fail by definition, and this one can as well. I am hopeful that it won't, but we better get our act together.
All right, and on this point, we'll end. JosephLeconte.com for more information. Joseph Leconte is spelled L-O-C-O-N-T-E. Thank you, sir. All the best.
Thanks so much, Jerry. Take care.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.